content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the April 2025 copy of Southern Living magazine. This week, we will complete the story we began last week about Turning the Page, a light-filled revival of a 120-year-old Athens, Georgia home opens a new chapter for a mother and her three kids. And then we're going to move on to our Rick Bragg and his Fried Chicken, a Love Story. No southern dish feeds the soul like this one. Sound good? I hope so. So we'll begin. The cover of this magazine, I won't re-describe the cover. You can refer to the last week's podcast if you'd like. But it says Southern Living, the South's best vacation of the year, restaurant of the year, barbecue joints, cities, classic hotels, cruises, resorts, seafood dives, and more. And it is a picture of Duck, North Carolina, a peninsula extending into the ocean. And it's got an ocean blue tone throughout. It seems to be the tone of this magazine. And it says, 50 best beach towns, the strange delight of pear salad, Aaron and Ben Napier's gorgeous greenhouse, and The Only Way to Make Fried Chicken by Rick Bragg, which we're going to hear about in just a short time. Now, we started last week an article called Turning the Page, a light-filled revival of a 120-year-old Athens, Georgia home opens a new chapter for a mother and her kids, her three kids. And we had stopped, we were describing a photo in the bedroom, and I'll read the caption of that photo. Maximize wall space. A smaller downstairs bedroom was converted into a spacious primary wing with an attached bath and a closet built where a back stairway had previously resided, as well as an intimate sitting room. Ramsey commissioned the wall-to-wall upholstered headboard to provide a pop of color. And listeners, that color is a grass green, light grass, olive, light olive green. And antique bird prints that had been stored away were hung in rows above the bed, suspended creatively using a brass rod rail. There are two rows, listeners, and they're each, the prints are adhered to the two vertical brass rails. About six of them that we can see here. All right, and now to continue and wrap up our article. There was an unsightly porch that had been tacked on at the rear of the house. It needed a major refresh, says Ramsey, who helped turn it into a flower-centric mudroom where Noland could indulge her love of gardening and arrange flowers. Meanwhile, a side room next to the entry was absorbed into the primary suite to create an inviting sitting area and private library, offering a special hideaway for holding Nolan's favorite reeds as well as family heirlooms. The kids have ended up using these rooms as much as me for their own hobbies, Nolan says. Core facets of the historic home were honored, including a closed floor plan, while other features, like the kitchen, were updated and expanded to better suit the family of four and their two dogs, Ava, a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, and Clue, a young Labrador retriever who, quote, helped break in the house, unquote, recalls Noland. To match the unique single-pane, vertically aligned window style in the existing kitchen, Ramsey commissioned perfect reproductions to flank an elegant AGA Elise range and allow in more light. Since she brought over many furniture pieces from her old house, we focused on transforming them to fit into her new aesthetic, says Ramsey, who reupholstered certain elements and dispersed dark wood antique furnishings amid lighter, breezier options. A sofa now used in the library was effectively sliced in half, recovered in a stylish boucle fabric, and given custom armrests that were made to match the built-in bookshelves. Thoughtful, undaunted uses of color throughout weave the whole place together from the moment you step onto the front porch, where the ceilings are coated in classic paint, H-A-I-N-T, blue paint. Cabinet, shelves, and interior millwork are washed in other shades of blue, which accent the library, kitchen, and coffered ceiling beams in the living room. The botanical-themed mudroom and her daughter's bedroom and bath are rooted in earthy greens. I lucked out that this house hadn't been touched in 60 years. Shag carpets, paneled walls and all, Nolan says, laughing. Now it's the perfect place for us. And now we'll move on to Rick Bragg and Fried Chicken, A Love Story. No southern dish feeds the soul like this one. And opposite the beginning of the story, listeners, is a full-page drawing, as Rick Bragg usually has accompanying his pieces. There usually has some kind of a cartoon or drawing, and this one is a drawing. The tones are white and light rose color are basically the tones of this. But it's a huge kitchen, an old-fashioned kitchen with some old-fashioned standalone appliances and cabinetry and wooden table, and pots and pans, and shelves in the background that have casseroles and pitchers and pieces on them, a pot hanging on the wall, a plant, looks like a pythas, that is trailing out of a white flower pot on a high shelf beside a coffee pot. And there is a window. It's a six-paned vertical-paned window. And there are rose-colored and white checkered curtains that are pulled back on either side of with a white curtain rod. And there are two tomatoes on a white windowsill before that window. And in the foreground, we have on the right side a middle-aged woman who is wearing a white blouse with some rose-colored, looks like flowers on it, and a light green full-length skirt, floor-length skirt, and a white apron, with bib apron. She has her gray hair in a bun. She's wearing a gray earring. She's got a slight smile on her face. One of her hands holds an oversized, again, this is a drawing, so it's a big oversized pot with one handle, and she has her hand on the handle of that pot, which is on the stove, and it actually extends over all four jets of the stove. And her right hand is extended out. Her right arm is extended. It's got some kind of bracelet on it, too, like a light, double-rowed light pink bracelet. And she's holding a tongs, very long, oversized silver tongs, oversized, and in the middle of them is a very oversized fried chicken leg. And that's rising above a plate that Rick, a cartoon of Rick Bragg, is sitting at the table, and he has his arms upheld very high above his head with the silver plate, not quite large enough for this chicken leg, but he's holding it up there with a smile on his face. And Rick Bragg's wearing, his shirt is open to a white undershirt and black trousers, and he's sitting at the table. Excuse me, they are brown trousers. The shirt, the undershirt that I referred to, is black on the bottom and white paneled on the top. And he has an overshirt, button shirt, that's opened. And that is beige and with rose-colored lines, checks kind of in there. And then there's a dog. We can just see his back in the lower left-hand corner. And he's looking up at probably the chicken. I was going to say Rick Brad, but we can't see exactly what he's looking at. He's looking at either his owner or the chicken. And, oh, there's someone here in the foreground, too. You can just see the top of his head. Appears to be, like, the same age of that woman. Might be the woman's husband. He's got thinning white hair and some reading glasses on. And the end of the cartoon ends just below his nose. And then there's a carpet with an abstract print, and it's this is kind of splashy. It looks to be watercolored, these colors in this drawing of rose tones and white and coffee-colored tones. And now on to the article by Rick Bragg. That illustration is by John Cuneo. The hospital rests atop a long, sloping hill. I've made the climb 1,000 times to see my people here. It gets steeper every year. A gray-haired man driving a hospital jitney watched me labor up the incline and offered me a ride. "How are you?" he asked. "I am old, I am tired, and I am grouchy," I answered. They do go together," he said. Inside, a queue of solemn, weary visitors moved slowly down a long hallway toward the cafeteria. I had just enough time to grab something to eat before visiting hours commenced, so I fell in step behind them. I was about halfway down the hall when I noticed a change. The pace had started to quicken. Footsteps seemed lighter. Worried faces softened, I swear, into actual smiles. I am too old to be mystified by much of anything, but this evaded me. Then I heard the answer, so simple, passed from person to person down the line. Fried chicken day was all they said. And suddenly, there it was, golden, fogging up the glass on the buffet. It was so hot it burned my fingers, the crust crisp and thin, and the juice ran when I cut into the meat. I ate the last crumbs with the tip of one finger. I think I might have sighed. People down here like to say, their food feeds the soul. Well, in a hospital cafeteria in Anniston, Alabama, over a leg and thigh, it sure seemed that way to me. Good fried chicken can do that in a way few other things can, said Terry Bradford, who's been head chef for 14 years at Northeast Alabama Regional Medical Center and has observed it too many times on too many worried faces. You see it when they take a bite. There is just something almost mystic in it, a blessing that is found sometimes in the least likely of places. So this is a love story, I guess, to this most southern of foods. I grew up on the best fried chicken on earth, prepared by old people who learned from other old people who learned from the dead. I have traveled a lifetime hoping to find something worthy of those memories. I have usually been disappointed, but now and then I can still taste it. I found it in a world-famous restaurant in Harlem, on the riverfront in Memphis, and in a strip mall joint in West Los Angeles. I found it high on Lookout Mountain, below sea level in New Orleans, and amid the bones of steel mills in Birmingham. I even found it in a grim, lonely gas station outside Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the only things on the menu were chicken backs and lima beans. That was 50 years ago, in a dim concrete block building with no sign and no other customers that I could see. So I wonder sometimes if it might have been a dream. If it was, I'd like to dream it again just one last time. And I found it right here, close to home, in A Man Who Cooks with Ghosts. My mother taught me, said Bradford, who comes from a family of great chefs in Calhoun County, Alabama. Her name was Gertrude. She had 9 boys and 5 girls. She had to cook and made us learn. I got to teach you boys especially, she told us. Some of you may not get no wife, so you got to know. Gertrude has passed away. But Bradford can almost feel her next to him as he makes each dish, like when he was a child, learning from a master. I've heard great cooks speak of this all my life, of ghosts or angels. Of course you taste it. 'Cause she's gonna make sure, he said. Folks say, too, that the best stories of the South are written in recipes. You hear it so much it begins to sound like just something to say. But I have seldom listened to my people speak of the past without talking, sooner or later, about chicken. We honor people with it. We sent it with my uncles to war and with my grandpa to prison for making whiskey. We cook it for weddings, divorces, and baptisms. Then baptisms again, because sometimes the first ones don't take. It is how we celebrate life or ease the pain of death. Or just a Thursday. But like so many real things down here, it's getting harder and harder to find. It's a laborious and messy process, frying chicken right, so people trade good chicken for easy chicken. I think these are the same ones who marry for money. So when you do find the real, rare thing, it is a kind of time machine. It may not have the pretensions of barbecue, but I'd climb over a mountain of pulled pork to get at a chicken thigh fried by someone who knows how. In my scientific mind, I understand it has not been good for me, for my arteries and my longevity. But I also know, deep in my raggedy heart, it has made the ride worthwhile. And listeners, this is just going to interrupt this story, because it is interrupted here on the page, by a photo that begins on one page and continues on the other, which we're about to read. And it is a family photo taken in the 1950s. And there is a mother holding a boy in one. And then there's another photo to the right, and that is 13. 12, looks like mostly girls, and 2 grown girls, and then 2, 1 toddler, and 1 woman is holding a baby. And here it says, from left, Rick's brother Sam and his mother, Margaret Bragg, in 1958. And the other photo that we just looked at is Rick's grandmother, Ava Bundrum, and Margaret in the center in a ruffled skirt in 1953. And they're out in the field under a tree. And they all look very happy. They're all laughing. All right, back to our story, our essay, listeners. When I was 6 years old, I spent weekends with my grandma Ava, so my mother could cook the Saturday shift at Red Steakhouse and Barbecue. Touches of mild dementia had already begun to show in Ava, but her daughters later referred to it gently as that time, you know, when Mama was still all right. Every Saturday morning, I'd sit at the kitchen table as she fried me the perfect chicken because she loved me. She was nearsighted and a little bow-legged, so it was great entertainment to help her run one down in the yard. In her flower print dress and heavy, sensible shoes, she'd cuss under her breath with every jerk and feint. She'd corner one, sooner or later, whack it on the head or neck with a broken broom handle, thank Jesus, and then scald, pluck, and clean it quickly, expertly. That is why you never, ever name a chicken. She would lightly dust the pieces with salt, flour, and a pinch of black pepper before frying them in lard in an ancient iron skillet. While cooking, she would talk nonstop to my grandpa, Charlie Bundram, who had been dead for 7 years. Maybe she wasn't as all right as the grown-ups believed. I thought she was perfect. When it was done, she would fork the pieces out, set them on a chipped ceramic platter, and cover them with a clean white cloth sewn out of flour sacks from the Great Depression. "Don't never use a melamine plate, child, 'cause it'll blister," she said. I waited in agony for it to cool, and then sat on the vinyl rug in front of the black and white Philco television, watching cartoons and holding a chicken leg in one hand and a biscuit in the other. "Oh, I'll get you, you wascally wabbit." Life has never been that good since. When I was done with a piece, I would take the bone, which was gnawed clean of everything, even gristle, and, when my grandma was not looking, toss it behind the couch. I don't know why. I was 6. When Ava would see my empty hand, she'd drop another drumstick into it. "That boy sure likes his chicken," she would say to the open window, the willow trees, and the man I guess only she could see. What made it so perfect, other than the love in it? My mother, Margaret, explained it to me, methodically, like she was reading off something scorched into a stone tablet by the blazing finger of God. First, it was the nature of the chicken itself. Her mother's pullets were grazed clean on a green yard, on a menu of crushed corn and wayward bugs, not manufactured in the crowd and reek of a modern-day factory farm, fattened on fish meal. "Chicken is supposed to taste like chicken," my mother told me. "Chicken tastes good." Second, it had to be a whole bird, cut up with a time-worn butcher knife, and fried in the same skillet with the gizzard, liver, neck, back, and that fatty little piece at the chicken's southernmost point, which my family of shade tree mechanics referred to as the running gear. Those morsels, like the skin, flavor it in a way no added ingredients could. And she never, ever cooked white meat only. "There ain't no flavor in the white meat," my mother said. "The only thing it's good for is holding the rest of the chicken together." Ava saved the breast for people she didn't like. Third, it was the crust. There should be almost none. No wet batter, no dip or dredge. Dust the damp chicken with dry flour. I told her how chefs on television, the ones with the weirdest hair, talked about how they layered wet and dry ingredients to get the proper crunch. "Ain't supposed to be no crunch," my mother said. "If it makes a noise at all when you bite into it, it should be an almost inaudible snap of crisp skin. not a sound like a drunk uncle crashing through a sliding glass door. Fourth, and perhaps most important, was her mother's restraint. How she used just enough grease to keep it from burning and added no strong seasoning of any kind. There's no pretension in it. That would ruin it. Some cooks try too hard, fuss too much. The ones who douse their chicken with pepper sauce or soak it in powerful brines have something to hide. I tried to explain the hot chicken craze to my mother, tried to tell her that a lot of people love it that way. "Why in the world would you pay money to hurt your own stupid self?" she asked. My mother's recipe, page 108, is as close to Ava's as she can get these days. She buys a whole chicken and often cooks it in oil instead of lard. Everything else is the same. "Keep it simple," she said, though she does not claim that tarted up chicken is all bad. It's fine for other people. When I was a boy, I believed that the greatest day in American history was June 14th. It was my grandma's birthday, and the best cooks in the whole world, her daughters, grandchildren, and other kin, all descended upon the little house on Roy Webb Road with tinfoil-covered mountains of fried chicken. I believed, stupidly, that it would never run out. But if you live long enough, everything does. I know some old men sit around and think about their grandchildren or good dogs, or that 1969 Firebird that looked fast even parked in the yard. They wonder what happened to their class ring after that girl, now what was her name, threw it slittering and bouncing across the parking lot of the TGY. But me, I think about the great chicken I have known. And listeners, that's our time for today. There's a little bit more in this article that we will continue next week to finish it up. And then if you'd like, we'll give you the recipe for this fried chicken. All right. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode and that you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once more, that's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.